It's time for the arts and culture of Western Wisconsin, the people, places, and performances. It's time for Spectrum West. Today, the music of Alexandre Dossine. He's coming back to the Heidi Center next week. We'll spend time talking about where he's been. Jim Oliver's here with what's on stage in Western Wisconsin. He also discusses writing and directing the latest installment in the popular Don't Hug Me series with Jim Zimmerman of the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater and Phil Olson, the playwright behind them. We'll also meet Joe Ryan, a UW-River Falls creative writing educator who not only engages in the craft, but some of that engagement is contained in a new book. And to begin, given the season, a little rhyme. The sounds of spring have their own distinct meter, like the echoes one hears along the red cedar. Take note and take in all such fine things, including the joy that your symphony brings. This weekend, the Red Cedar Symphony presents a couple concerts that rejoice in the season and celebrate homegrown talent. Saturday evening in Cumberland and Sunday afternoon in Rice Lake, audiences will support their very own symphony orchestra as they have for over 30 years. I spent some time talking with musical director Kevin Peters just a couple days ago. You have some real diversity built into your spring concerts, the contemporary and the classical, plus you have some competition winners as soloists. You have the sultry Summertime of Gershwin and a Bernstein overture coupled with a Mozart opera and a couple movements of a timeless Tchaikovsky symphony, and you're performing twice and in different locations.
The spring concert is a very exciting one for us because it does include our concerto competition winners. You know, I think this year we've got a particularly diverse set of winners. Nancy Keeler, one of our own musicians, is playing bassoon on Gershwin's Summertime, and I'm going to guess the majority of our listeners have not seen a bassoon concerto performed before. So Nancy will be performing Summertime, and she actually found this piece a couple years ago and has been eyeing it as an option for the concerto competition. We're thrilled to feature her and the jazzy sounds of Summertime, and a lot of her solo is improv. She's improvising it, so that's very exciting. The other winner from Amory, Wisconsin, is Jade Nustold, performing a beautiful aria, Dove Sono, from Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. And this particular aria, the Countess lamenting her broken heart and her husband's wandering affections. So it's very emotional, lots of long legato phrases, and Jade's got a fantastic voice, and we're really excited to feature her as well. The concert is called Anniversaries of the Great, so we're celebrating two anniversaries, the centennial celebration of Leonard Bernstein. He would be 100 this year, so we're performing the Overture to Candide, which is an operetta that not too many people have probably seen the version on stage, but many of them have heard the music. Certainly the music has become more popular than the stage production. And then we'll be performing the famous Tchaikovsky Fifth Symphony. We're only doing two movements of that, the second and the fourth, but that completes our concert in a rousing fashion and features a beautiful horn solo in the second movement, nice legato, beautiful movement to that. So we're looking forward to a diverse concert here.
Are there a lot of things? I like talking about the bassoon. I don't know why. It makes me think I should have played the bassoon years ago. Are there a lot of numbers? Probably not, just written for bassoon.
I'm not familiar with a lot of solo numbers for it. A lot of times what will happen for an instrument like that is they might transcribe a cello work or a trombone solo, for instance, or something in a similar range. This particular solo that she's playing was actually a saxophone solo. That happens with a lot of instruments. They'll steal works from other instruments' catalogs and transpose them and transcribe them for what works for them.
Kevin Peters, musical director, Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra. Big weekend coming up Saturday evening in Cumberland, Sunday afternoon in Rice Lake. We'll give you the specifics. Kevin, the idea of taking the show on the road really does a nice job of solidifying the fact that you belong to everyone in Northwest Wisconsin. Does it feel that way as you go out and about and show your stuff to different kinds of people in different venues?
Absolutely. You know, we are a true regional orchestra. I mean, we draw our musicians from probably more than a 90-mile radius. I know we've got people that drive hour and a half or more to come into rehearsals. So we truly embrace that, and we want to reach out into the other cities and let them know that we're here and that we've got a fantastic orchestra performing in the Northwest region of Wisconsin. So we've had great success in our partners in Cumberland at Augustana Lutheran Church, as well as in Chautauqua at the Lutheran Church there, and our audiences continue to grow in those locations as we kind of develop our own unique audience there. And I must say, at this concert, the United Fund of Cumberland has given us a grant that provided us with 50 adult tickets that we could give out free of charge to students so their parents were able to bring them. Of course, students 21 and under get in for free, but now we were able to give 50 tickets to parents to bring their students so they can hopefully a whole new crop of young students will be in the audience enjoying our performance this Saturday.
Are there other venues that you have taken the orchestra to, and if so, what are they?
We have taken the orchestra on the road to other cities. We've been up in Shell Lake. I know we've been to Barron. We've been out in Ladysmith. But we've kind of found that by keeping these rotations between Cumberland and Chautauqua, we're drawing people from beyond those cities, and it's kind of becoming a little regional site. And it's been fun to develop an audience in each of those towns, and you start seeing those same faces out in the audience and getting to know them a little bit.
The concerto competition is a biennial one. Tell me a little bit about the history of the concerto competition. How long has that been going on?
That's been going on for many years. It's been something that we want to feature other local musicians. You know, we always encourage high school students to audition for it as well. You know, in some years we get a lot, other years we don't get many of them auditioning, but it's an opportunity for, you know, local soloists to be featured. We're not looking to draw the big name soloists from the Twin Cities or other major areas. We want it to be a way to feature our local musicians. So we've had great success with that the past several years.
Kevin Peters and the Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra is our topic. Concerts coming up this weekend, Saturday, 7 p.m., Augustana Lutheran Church in Cumberland. Sunday, 4 p.m., Bethany Lutheran Church in Rice Lake. So I have to ask, what's planned for the summer? You going to be in the park again? What's going on?
We will be in the park again. That concert is going to be on Tuesday, August 7th at 7 p.m. So that'll, of course, be a free Pops concert in conjunction with Rice Lake's Music in the Park. And then within the next several weeks, we'll be announcing on our website, redcedarsymphony.org, our next season, the 2018-2019 season, which will be another fun season. We're going to continue on with the Homegrown series as well, so people can continue to like our Facebook page and look at the website for those details coming out.
Well, you blew that next question right out of the water. My question was, are you already planning the 2018-19 season? Guess what? You're way ahead of me.
Yeah, I've got my list of things I want to get in.
Yes, and you got them in. That's fine. Oh, yeah. When do you start planning the next season? Obviously, early.
I've been thinking about it since fall and go through multiple revisions, and I'll send some sample programs out. What do you guys think of this? And some people might point this out or that out, You know, I've swapped things out. The themes right now, I think I'll stick with. One concert's going to be a dance theme. That'll feature Polovitsian dances by Borodin, as well as some folk dances and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is going to be spoken word. And I'm nearly positive we're going to do Peter and the Wolf this fall.
Oh, there you go.
Which has the narration. And then I'm thinking of doing, there's a couple other pieces out there of Prokofiev and Tchaikovsky that are from some Shakespeare connections.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking of reading the Shakespeare passage and then doing the pieces, somehow involving all spoken word into the music. So I'm still kind of working on finalizing, but I figured as long as we've got the narrator there for Peter and the Wolf, that was a good tie in there.
Yeah, no kidding. Kevin yep. Peters, always a pleasure. Have a great weekend of concerts. I know the people in Cumberland and Rice Lake are looking forward to you guys showing up. Thanks so much, and keep in touch with WPR.
Thanks, Al. Always appreciate your time.
The place for information is the website redcedarsymphony.org. As Kevin mentioned, they're on Facebook as well, where if you've watched the news lately, you can join the Russians a bit. You know, come to think of it, they're playing Tchaikovsky this week. Oh, that must just be a coincidence. Coming up on Spectrum West, Alexandre Dossin has landed and is in our midst preparing for a Tuesday concert. Jim Oliver is here, and next, Do As I Do rings so often true. Support for WPR comes from 4 and 5 of Chippewa Falls, offering the Bridal Suite with personalized service to select bridal and bridesmaid gowns, tuxedos, and accessories. More information available at 4and5.com. Support also comes from Neff's Pianos in Eau Claire, announcing a spring event the week of April 2nd, featuring reconditioned Kauai and Yamaha pianos. More about extended hours and appointments available at neffspianos.com. The name is Joe Ryan. He's an educator at UW River Falls, teaching the art of creative writing, a vocation that fits like an expensive Italian suit. You see, he's a creative writer who has just released, through his current publisher, Press 53, a book of short stories called Roads Without Houses. I received the book with just one day to review, so I've only dipped my toe in, and I'm looking forward to a headlong dive. So let's begin with your scrapbook. You come from the geologically flatter part of Wisconsin, with which I am also very familiar. Tell me about the inspirations that you found in Kimberly, Wisconsin, that led you down literary paths. Was it a teacher, a book, an author? And you're not a very old guy. I mean, I was going to say maybe a library, but you've probably lived in an internet world since your formative years.
Sort of. I guess I feel like I'm old enough, or at least an old enough soul, I guess, where I still love the feel of a book as opposed to looking at a screen. And so I did spend a lot of time just in my local library that I just gave that reading at. So it was great to go back there and actually be the author there. Yeah, I had a handful of teachers who really helped me realize that not only could I do this thing well, but that it was something worth pursuing. So from fifth grade on, I had a teacher who I wrote this story about, I think it was like a gazelle maybe running away from a cheetah. She really praised it, and I was like, oh, that's great. I didn't at that point, I didn't quite know that I was good at it, but I liked it. But then I had one particular teacher in high school, Mrs. Gofford. I wrote a story for her, and she pushed me to pursue this writing contest for Fox Cities Magazine, actually. And so I did, and I ended up winning that contest. Cool. And again, that was the moment where I saw that, okay, this is something that I really like to do, and maybe I'm good at it, but it's also something that's worth doing, worth getting your work out there. And I've always been a reader. My mom still has the little tote that I would carry around with my books and little books on tape. And all of that sort of led me to just pursue it in college and beyond.
Your book is called Roads Without Houses. It contains about 15 short stories. These are all standalone short stories. However, some characters meander through the entire book, I guess. And some of the story titles contain proper names. Now, even though it's 15 separate pieces, is there a way to provide a thumbnail overview of the book other than characters? Does anything else recur?
Yeah, thematically, the idea of Roads Without Houses, and that's the title of one of the stories, but the idea thematically is sort of that all of these characters are on some sort of road of their life that they didn't intend to be on. Some of them don't know how they got there, and some of them just don't know how to get off of that road. And so a common struggle, I guess, of all the characters is that they don't feel that they are doing what it is they need to be doing in life. They are standalone stories in that I didn't want to sort of hit that same note over and over again 15 times because that would get repetitive. So I didn't want them to be too thematically linked other than that sort of larger, looser one. And that's where the links came in. Geographically, they're all centered around not just Kimberly. There are some in North Wisconsin. There are some in the Twin Cities, some in Milwaukee. It's sort of all of these places that I've actually lived or spent a good amount of my time. And that's why the characters dip into each other's lives, but they're not recurring. They're not central to each other's lives because I did want them to all be standalone stories. I didn't want you to have to read the entirety of the collection together to get each individual piece of it. But I also found something nice in that it sort of mimicked life a lot in that way, where these characters don't know each other, and sometimes when they interact, they have very meaningful interactions, and sometimes they just pass each other, and it's it's a passing instance that doesn't do anything. And I think that it sort of mimics life a little bit in that way, in that we don't know when our roads will divert. We don't know when those important moments will come, and when they do, we often don't know who's going to be a part of them.
Mm-hmm. It's fictional work. Though it's fiction, are any of the characters fashioned after people who are part of Joe Rhine's non-fictional world?
Probably. I think to a degree that fiction writers sort of always mind their lives a little bit.
Sure.
But I do try to never sort of get too close to any particular person and use them as a character basis, because I think the tendency then becomes that you're sort of afraid to either portray them accurately or to even hurt them or to do things in the story that you would normally otherwise do. The places all exist. A lot of the characters have names of people that I know, because when you're writing a short story collection, you have to come up with an absurd amount of names for all of these characters. But I always use the sound of the name as opposed to relation to people that I know. And, if anything, a lot of the fears that the characters have are fears that I have, or situations of people that I know that they've been in. Then I try to separate from that and just look at the situation itself, not necessarily what happened in that person's life.
Okay. A conversation with Joe Rhine. He's an associate professor of creative writing at UW River Falls. His book, Roads Without Houses, has just been published, and we'll tell you how to get that in a little bit. I read that you revisited some earlier work and found that you had grown as a writer. Makes you wonder what Joe Rhine will be writing 10 years from now.
It does. I looked back at the writing that I did then, and when I updated the stories, as I said, it seemed that I just sort of matured from then. A lot of the writing was idealistic, or it was trying too hard, or it was reaching. And now I'm at the point where I'm a year removed from writing Roads Without Houses. At this point, I still like everything about it, but in 10 years, I'm wondering if I look back at this, will I feel the same way? Or as I'm writing 10 years from now, will I still look back at this and see that even the process of writing this book itself was something that, matured me as a writer, I suppose.
Is the process, the writing process, part of how a writer grows? Is it just in what you're writing about, or is it a little bit of everything?
I think both of those definitely come into play. When I look back at my older work, I think what I was writing about wasn't the immature part about it. I think maybe what felt immature to me was the amount of work I put in after I had gotten that first draft down. So maybe that's the writing process portion of it. Now I'm spending 3/4 of my time or more after it's down just looking at it and going, okay, what do I have here?
Sure.
I think early in my writing career, I was always striving for some ideal in my head with the story. Now I look at the story after it's written and I sort of know, well, it's not going to be exactly what I intended starting out, but maybe it's going to be something different and probably something better, and let's go towards that.
Sure.
And so a lot more work comes in the back end.
Well, here's a real challenge. What you should do is take that fifth grade story about a gazelle and turn it into a novel.
I think it was probably about 2 paragraphs long, so that would be quite the feat.
Yeah.
If I could do that.
Well, that might be down the road. Who knows? In a release, I read that students care about the creative credentials of their instructors, and I can see where that would be. It's cool to get published. Is that the term that denotes ultimate success in the writing field, getting published? I mean, today, given the broad brush of the Internet, can fame or legitimacy be attained without publishing?
It certainly can, and that's why I never disparage any form of self-publication or students who are interested in doing it. A lot of times that the way to gain the most readers is, as you said, through that route. Because I'm in academia and working in the professor position, I wanted to get into a job where I knew working towards publication in the way that Roads Without Houses came about and in the more traditional avenues are also valued for my job, not just for my own personal writing career.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, I'm likely to still continue on this road, that publication road, because it comes with the professional credentials as well, where I think that's the divide, I suppose, right now that exists in publishing. it may merge, and it's already sort of starting to merge, but academia hasn't yet caught up to that aspect of it. Perhaps when it does, then my strategy will change. But as for right now, that's sort of the world that I live in.
The publishing deal that produced Roads Without Houses came about by a writing competition offered by the publisher known as Press 53. Will you be publishing more work with them?
Publishing wasn't a part of being a finalist. It actually took a few steps thereafter in contact between me and the publisher, and it wasn't quite a collection the way that it is now. And I think that was part of working with my editor. If it were to continue on with this press, which does short story collections and poetry collections exclusively, it would be another project in that vein. Right now, I have my sights set on a novel.
Okay, well, keep us in the loop on the development of your novel. You brought up the term editor. I've talked to a lot of writers over the years. These are people who sit in their homes and write, and they don't teach creative writing. How's the relationship between an educator who may think he or she knows everything there is to know about creative writing? How's the relationship between you and an editor being an educator in the field?
It's recognizing that they do this every day as their job, and they read a lot. They read submissions of the kind that you're trying to get published. At first, I had the instinct, as most writers do, to sort of say, no, this was my intention, this is what it needed to be. But when you step back from that, you actually recognize that editors aren't trying to take over your work.
Sure.
They're not trying to change it for their own, or at least the good editors won't. The good editors will just be trying to take what you've done and make it as good as that can be.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you put yourself in that mindset, you can take the criticism actually fairly well after an initial gut reaction, which is always sort of there. And ultimately, the end product is almost always better, and that's why writers always talk positively about working with their editors. The good ones will help guide that vision. In the end product, you're thankful because it is better because of their input.
A professional perspective on your writing that you didn't have.
It feels very good to have somebody that invested in your work.
Joe Rhine, Associate Professor, Creative Writing, UW River Falls. The book is Roads Without Houses. How do we get that book?
It's available on all booksellers online. Press53.com has a link to my author page, and getting the book straight from the press is one of the fastest ways. Other online booksellers, I think you can find it in most of those places as well.
Look for the name Joseph Rhine on the book, obviously. I've been saying Joe, like you and I have known each other for years.
No one calls me Joseph outside of my immediate family. You know, you go by the full professional name as an author, but even the sign on my office door says Joe. So.
Oh, good.
Yep.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And as I said previously, keep us in the loop as your novel takes shape. I look forward to talking to you when that is published. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Al. I appreciate it.
Spectrum West on WPR, another educator finding time to share his talent. Coming up, Alexandre Dossine is in Wisconsin and takes the stage of the Heidi Center next Tuesday. Right now, though, Jim Oliver quickly makes a lot of friends in the vast Western Wisconsin theater community. This week, he spends time with two of them and shares that time with all of us.
Don't Hug Me, We're Family is the sixth in the Don't Hug Me series of musical comedies. Now, as I understand it, it premiered in California this past February. And it's currently playing at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson through May the 19th. Joining us by telephone are the director, Jim Zimmerman, and the playwright, Phil Olson, who has written the story and lyrics in collaboration with his brother, Dr. Paul Olson, who has written the music. So welcome to you both.
No, thank you. Appreciate it.
Phil, you and your brother went to school in Edina, Minnesota. You graduated from Dartmouth College, where you were an all-Ivy League discus thrower on the track team and an all-Ivy League tight end on the football team. You had a tryout with the NFL Chicago Bears and earned an MBA from the University of Chicago. Dr. Paul Olson is head of the nephrology department and a medical clinic in Shakopee, Minnesota. How did you two get started writing musical plays?
Yeah, it wasn't your typical musical theater background. I had no musical theater or any theater background whatsoever. I was in business down in Tampa, Florida, and one of my clients produced industrial films, and they asked me if I wanted to be an actor for one weekend because they were short actors. So I said, sure, and they didn't have a script. They just said, just improvise it. And so I was improvising these scenes in these industrial films, and they kept asking me back because they didn't have to hire a writer. And then I started to enjoy kind of performing. I'd never done it before. And then I got into writing sketch comedy and eventually moved to Los Angeles and started to write plays and screenplays. And I got the idea for Don't Hug Me. And my brother was a musician all through high school and all through college. So he's done quite well at that, although he is a doctor. But I asked him if he would write the music for the original Don't Hug Me. And he said, sure. This is our sixth one that we've written together. It's been a really great collaboration. He writes the music first and sends me the computer files of the music sheets, and then I write the lyrics to the music. A lot of people do it the other way around. They write the lyrics first, but we do it music first.
How does a kid from Edina, Minnesota relate to life in Bunyan Bay up near Canada?
Yeah, we're... We used to go to camp up in Camp Warren when we were little, and my brother, whose nickname is Bear, he was big for his age. Where we went to camp was kind of like where Bunyan Bay, Minnesota is, up near the Canadian border. And then when we were kids, Dad, Mom would take us up to a little resort in Bemidji. So we've spent a lot of time up in that part of Minnesota and are very familiar with it. And then as far as the Don't Hug Me stuff, I grew up in a very emotionally reserved, I'm 100% Norwegian American, is what you'd say, but my great-grandparents came over from Norway and both sides of the family, and the closest we came to hugging was that kind of arm's length, pat on the shoulders, kind of awkward hug. And my dad would tell us that he was the Norwegian who loved his wife so much he almost told her. And, you know, we'd hear things like, you know, tell me you love me, honey. Oh, I told you I loved you when we got married. If anything changes, I'll let you know. So that is what I grew up with. Mm-hmm. And I'm very familiar with northern Minnesota. So combine those two things and you've got Don't Hug Me.
Uh-huh. Well, your plays have had, well, I've got two different numbers, 200 productions or 300 productions. It's a lot of them anyway, no matter what. Around the United States and Canada, they seem popular in California. Why would a Californian be so interested in Bunyan Bay, Minnesota?
Don't Hug Me musicals have played in about 28 states around the country and all through Canada. And I think because the themes are universal, they're stories about a relationship, how a couple has been married for quite a long time and the romance has kind of left their marriage and it needs to be rekindled. So I think a lot of people can relate to the storylines or the themes, but also I think that they're kind of enamored by the quirkiness of the characters. It's just kind of a fun family musical comedy that people are kind of interested in that culture. And this one, Don't Hug Me, We're Family, we have that quirky northern Minnesota kind of Scandinavian culture, and we're combining it with two Brooklyn Italians that come into town. And so we've got this fish out of water element that seems to be resonating.
We are talking to Phil Olson, who has written the most recent Don't Hug Me play, Don't Hug Me, We're Family. Jim Zimmerman, who is directing the show at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson, will join us in just a minute. But I want to ask Phil, are there any more Don't Hug Me plays in the works?
I'm going to write one or two non-musical plays over the next couple of years, but I do have one, Don't Hug Me, It's a Family Reunion. I'm thinking about that being the last. So I think there's one more.
Well, Jim Zimmerman, what attracted you to the plays originally?
Success, basically. I've known him for a lot of years, but one of the things that Phil doesn't talk about himself that he really needs to is that he is one heck of a writer. He writes comedy like very few people can do. The rhythms, the punchlines, the character structure of the shows, they all blend to generally fail-safe, successful shows. And so when we got connected with the very first Don't Hug Me, I read it and I knew that it was going to be something special on stage. And everyone after that has been that same formula and that same writing style. And that's what propelled me to want to do anything that Phil writes. He wrote a Christmas show a couple of years ago, and we did that last year. A Nice Family Christmas is the name of it, a sequel to the, of another play he wrote called A Nice Family Gathering. And A Nice Family Christmas had that same style, and it was also a success for us.
Have you done all of the Don't Hug Me shows?
Yes, we've done every one, and one we've done even twice. Don't Hug Me Christmas Carol we mounted twice and may do again.
Phil alluded a little bit to what the show is about, but tell us about Don't Hug Me, We're Family.
Well, Don't Hug Me, We're Family continues the story of Clara and Gunnar, the owners of the Bunyan in the mythical town Bunyan Bay, not unlike Hibbing. And in this episode of the story, the husband and wife who own this bar-restaurant are going through a bit of hard times. Numbers are down in terms of sales and things like that, so they've supplemented their income by bringing in a radio station, KOLD Radio, into the Bunyan. And so there, when the folks come to the theater, they'll see that the Bunyan restaurant bar is now a section of it cordoned off for a radio station, and both Clara and Gunnar have radio shows on that station. Of course, Clara, the wife, is doing great work, and absolutely nobody is listening to Gunnar's programs. And then, to complicate matters, he brings in Sal Carducci and his wife because they have bought the radio station, and all sorts of things happen when this outsider, this New Yorker, comes into the Bunyan with good spirit and good intent, but mixes things up tremendously. In the end, Gunnar and Clara, after going through some trial separation because they weren't getting along, finally get back together and all works out well at the Bunyan again.
Uh-huh. I'm just curious, are you able to keep the cast together for the Don't Hug Me shows?
Folks want to come back and do these shows, like I said, because of the writing. Mm-hmm. And yes, for the most part, there have been some characters that rotated, but we have primarily the same cast as we had for many of our Don't Hug Me mountings of the original and the sequels on stage with us for this show.
Well, it would seem to me that particularly the main characters, it would be almost necessary to keep the same actors wearing the same faces, so to speak.
Jason DeShane and Steph Briggs Osmond are Gunnar and Clara, and they have been stalwarts working with our theater in most all of the Don't Hug Me series of shows. That chemistry works out really well, both for the audience and for me, because I can walk into rehearsals, and we've already got the characters developed because we've done five other shows or six other shows with them. It's a big time saver, not to mention the fact that they just kill in these roles. I mean, they are very funny.
Phil, I have to ask you, I spent quite a bit of time on your website, and I'm just curious, how much input do you have in doing your webpage?
The PhilOlson.com website, is that the one?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I designed that, which I am not a web designer. Anyone out there, let me know. I need help. I pretty much did that. It kind of looks like a collage of all sorts of stuff just thrown together.
Well, I found it very informative, and that's all I care about. I don't care what it looks like.
Well, thank you. Then I'll keep it. All right, never mind.
Okay, well, that's fine.
Don't.
Jim Zimmerman, I can't let you go without bugging you some more about your own writing. You know, you've written your own shows, and so I'm just wondering, how are things going in the writing front for you?
Well, they go on a daily basis as time allows. Owning a dinner theater slows you down from time to time. Certainly, Phil has a lot to do with my writing. You know, when I wrote the original Righteous and the rewrite of That I Love and Feelin', Phil was collaborative throughout that process and helped us actually premiere the show out in L.A. That show is now in a publication. We're just doing the third set of proofs on the actual published version, and that'll be going out today. It will then become unrestricted, and folks can do that. Mm-hmm. I've got, like Phil, three or four shows running around in my head that I'm actually working on, and one of those is going to show up at our dinner theater, I suspect, in a year or so. As Phil would say, you don't finish a show as much as you abandon it. I've heard him say that a dozen times, and it's absolutely true.
Well, we've been talking to Jim Zimmerman, who is director of the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater of Hudson's production of Don't Hug Me, We're Family. He's been joined by the playwright, Phil Olson, who wrote the musical in collaboration with his brother, Dr. Paul Olson. The show will run Fridays and Saturdays through May 19th. Jim and Phil, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Well, yeah, thank you, Jim.
You know, being a busy but generous guy, it's good to catch Jim on the run. There's more happening on stages across western Wisconsin. He has it.
Once Upon a Mattress, a fractured fairy tale musical comedy, will be performed Fridays and Saturdays through March 31st at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. Pippin will be staged through Sunday by the Northern Star Theater of Rice Lake. The Heidi Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls will present a Jerry Way production of Class Reunion, a mystery musical comedy, through Sunday. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present Charlotte's Web, April 6th through the 8th, in the State Theater in Eau Claire. The Clear Lake Community Theater will present The Addams Family, April 6th through the 8th and the 13th through the 15th in the Clear Lake Community Center. And the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson has scheduled auditions for The Red Box, a Nero Wolfe mystery based on a novel by Rex Stout. They've been scheduled for 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday, April 8th, and 7 to 9 p.m. Monday, April 9th at the Phipps. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. I'm Jim Oliver.
Thank you, as usual, sir. This is Spectrum West on WPR. And support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Marquardt Toyota, dedicated to providing an enjoyable and stress-free buying process with welcoming facilities located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or at marquardttoyota.com. His first name looks like Alexander, except it ends with R-E. It's pronounced Alexandre. The last name is Dosine. His instrument is the piano. He chairs the piano department at the University of Oregon, but has ties to Eau Claire, having taught here earlier in his career. Alexandre Dosine is returning to perform at the Heidi Center. We spoke via a rather unpredictable phone line, Wisconsin to Oregon, just the other day. How did your love affair and acquaintance with the piano begin? What about music education in Brazil?
I was simply very lucky to have a piano in our house, in our apartment. My mom played a little bit of the piano, so we had this old upright piano. She told me that when I was little, I would come from kindergarten, probably I was 5 or 6, and I would go to the piano, open the piano, and start playing the melodies that I just heard in my kindergarten class. Mm-hmm. So she noticed, of course, I had a good ear, and I could play by ear. And she came and asked, oh, do you like to study piano? And I said, sure, of course. Mm-hmm. And that's how it started. And it was always very natural. She was never pushy in terms of putting me to practice or anything. And the piano was basically always open. I could go there at any given time and play a little bit. So little by little, it became bigger and bigger in my life. Still, she wouldn't force me to practice or anything. I just loved playing I loved playing for people. I started doing performances in front of people when I was 7. Mm. And those were always magical moments for me. So my mom understood that in order for me to practice, I needed to have performances.
Sure.
So she kept finding some performances for me, and that was the only way she knew I was going to practice, because I'm not a big fan of practicing for the sake of practicing. Uh-huh. I like to practice because I know I cannot perform without the practice.
Now I'm interested in how the roads opened up for you, because as I read, you were in Brazil until the age of 19, and then the roads took you to Texas, and they took you to Russia. Tell me about that progression. How did that all happen?
I actually went to Russia when I just turned 19, but I was in Brazil and performing quite a lot, and I knew people who heard me. Teachers and other concert pianists always told me, oh, you need to leave, you need to go abroad, you need to go to Europe or the United States. Mm-hmm. because Brazil doesn't have the kind of musical education and competition and level that you need. But we didn't have any money, so I couldn't afford to go even to Rio or to São Paulo, much less abroad. So
sure, okay.
I kept trying, and then I looked for sponsorships and see if I could find some help. Finally, in 89, I heard about a Russian professor who was coming to Rio de Janeiro for master classes. I was told he had a scholarship to give away. We found money somehow. Some friend helped me go to Rio to play for him. And to make a long story short, I ended up getting that scholarship. So I studied with him for the first 2 years in Moscow, from 89 to 91. And then I applied. He prepared me to audition for the Moscow Conservatory, which I then was admitted in 91. And that scholarship was unbelievable, was just everything that I could dream of, because it included airfare from Brazil to Russia. Mm-hmm. It included full tuition for all 9 years that I was there. It included a stipend every month, which was pretty generous.
Wow.
And also included winter clothing. So and a piano in my room. So I had a piano to practice in my room. I basically stayed there for 9 years total in Moscow.
University of Texas, Austin, well known for piano or for...
Well, what happened with Texas was that while in Moscow, I played many competitions. One of them was at the selection for the Van Cliburn competition in Texas.
Oh, sure.
Which one of the selection rounds was in Moscow. So since I was there, I applied and I played the selection. And they travel all around the world. They go to, I don't know, 7 or 8 big cities around the world. And they select from the, whatever, 300 applicants, 35 to go to Texas for the finals of the Van Cliburn competition. And then they pay everything. They pay your way there. They pay your... You live really well for 3 weeks in Texas. So I was really fortunate to have been selected as one of the 35. So I came to Texas in 97. To participate in the Van Cliburn competition, despite the fact that I didn't win a prize at the actual competition in Texas, that's a huge visibility. And the professors from the University of Texas recruited me to Texas, and they said, if you'd like to come, we'll give you everything here, full tuition, everything. And I was a teaching assistant there, so I was doing my doctorate and teaching piano lessons as well.
Wow.
And that's how my life in the West started, was in Texas.
You sound like you have had, at least in the earlier years, you were in the right places at the right time.
That's right, yeah. That's a big part of my life.
We're talking with Alexandre Dossine, pianist, University of Oregon School of Music and Dance. He's a professor of piano and chair of the piano department. You'll say, well, why are you talking to somebody from Oregon? Well, he's coming to play at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls Tuesday, March 27th. That is less than a week away, 7:30 p.m. You served for a few years on the faculty at UW-Eau Claire, a well-known and respected music department in its own right. Tell me how that came about and a bit of your memory of your time here in Wisconsin.
Oh, I have great memories in Wisconsin. That was my first official position as a professor, actually, because once I finished my doctorate, I was hired as a visiting professor in Louisiana for a one-year position. And during that year in Louisiana, I looked for permanent positions where I could stay for a longer time. And Eau Claire was one of the positions I applied, and I received an offer. And when I visited Eau Claire for my interview, I really loved it. I felt a great place. We had, at that time, a three-year-old girl who is now in college. I thought it would be a great place to raise our kids. We are planning to have more kids. And indeed we had. Our son was born in Eau Claire. So we had a wonderful 4 years in Eau Claire. It was really beautiful time of our lives. We still have great friends in Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls as well. I'm going to stay with very close friends in Chippewa Falls. I've been going back several times. Actually, I played at Heide Center, 2 or 3 times at least since I came to Oregon. And it's always a pleasure to play there. I love that place. I love the location, and of course I know many of the audience members personally, so it becomes like playing for friends. So it's a very special place for me.
There are so many things to say about you. You've been called the master of contrasts. You are vice president of the American Liszt Society. Of course, we've all heard about Franz Liszt, but he was a 19th century concert superstar. That's the way they list him. Is that a good way to briefly define the society's role, supporting his legacy as a pianist? How did your involvement in that get underway?
He was a superstar, and he was in his time really the most famous pianist ever. Every place he would go, people would meet him on the streets, and the ladies would go crazy. He would throw his gloves to the audience, and the ladies would jump for the gloves and
wow.
Keep that as mementos. You know, he would play for popes and for the Russian tsars, and I mean he was really on the top of top. But the society, the American Liszt Society, was created to disseminate not only his work as a pianist, but mainly, of course, his compositions, because he's a great composer and a great teacher as well. So Liszt was someone who, as a performer, as a teacher, as a conductor, as just an overall great musician, he transformed the 19th century in many ways. So the American Liszt Society is a great organization. I have a great group of friends on the board of directors. A couple of years ago, I became vice president because it is a beautiful society of not only pianists. I mean, we have people from other instruments as well. We have people who are not musicians who just enjoy music, good music, and we try to disseminate his music and also disseminate a beautiful way to play his music, because unfortunately Franz Liszt was such a virtuoso that his music is very difficult and it's not for everyone. I mean, you really need lots of technique to play it. Many people just play those pieces without any care to the musical aspects of the music. They just think if they play fast and loud, that will be great.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the main roles we have in the Liszt Society is the dissemination of good performance of Franz Liszt. So I brought two very important pieces by Franz Liszt to my recital. One of them is probably the most important work he ever wrote, which is the Sonata in B minor. It's a 30-minute long piece, no intermission. It's a very impressive piano work. I'm going to do that in the first half together with some pieces by Chopin. And in the second half, I will actually conclude the recital with another piece by Liszt, which display his wonderful control of the instrument and in the way he transformed a whole opera into a piano piece. The Waltz from Gounod's Faust.
Pianist Alexandre Dossin coming to the Heidi Center on the 27th. Are you also a composer?
No. I used to do for fun when I was a teenager. I did compose a few pieces, but nothing serious and nothing professionally speaking. That's something that I think all musicians should be able to do and should do it at some point of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
I do compose my own cadenzas when I play concerti. So when I play Mozart or Beethoven, quite often, instead of using their own cadences, I compose my own and try to explore in that way a little bit of my creativity as not only as a pianist but also as a composer. But no, by I don't consider myself a composer. Maybe later on in my life, if I have more time, I will dedicate some time to that. But at this point, I'm really busy with performing and recording careers, and of course the teaching career, which is very important for me as well. I try just to live one day at a time.
Yes, well, you're living it fully, from what I can tell. Alexandre Dossin, thanks so much for being with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're looking forward to seeing you, meeting you, and above all, hearing you play.
Thank you very much, Alfred. Love to meet you in person. Thank you.
Well, that's good stuff. The Heidi website is cvca.net. Showtime is 7:30 p.m. Tuesday. Chance to see one of the true piano talents in the world today. Here's some Spectrum memos. Don't forget the Lady Laughs Comedy Tour visits the Plus, downtown Eau Claire tonight if you're listening Thursday. The Menominee Art Music Society presents music in March, Friday evening, 7 o'clock, United Methodist Church in Menominee. Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts welcomes Them Cooley Boys Friday at 7:30. And Sweet Dreams and Honky Tonk Sunday evening, same time, 7:30, MabelTainter.org. The Osseo Fairchild High School Music Department presents All Shook Up Thursday and Friday, 7:30 p.m. That's tonight and tomorrow. If you're listening Thursday, plus two shows Saturday at 1:30 and 7:30 p.m. Tickets at the office, at the high school, United Bank or Alliance Bank, and at the door. The FIPS Choral Society presents Franz Schubert's Mass in G Sunday at 2 p.m. at Bethel Lutheran Church in Hudson. Thanks to Kate, Dean, and Hannah for weekly collaboration. Coming up next week, we're going to talk improv, and you know what that means. We'll be making things up right on the spot. We'll talk about the art of photography. The Eau Claire Children's Theater is busy as usual, and more. Always more here on Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross for Jim Oliver. Thank you so much, and let's do it again next week, shall we?